Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the release today of a report from the U.S. Global Change Research Program that says climate change is no longer a distant threat, but a clear and present danger. Dr. Brenda Eckwessel, who leads the Union of Concerned Scientists' climate science education and policy work, joins us from the White House where the report was released today. We will discuss the report that offers global and regional current and anticipated impacts of climate change on infrastructure, agriculture, human health, and access to water. Then we'll look into what help the U.S. might be offering the Nigerian government in its faltering effort to retrieve over 200 schoolgirls captured by Boko Haram, whose leader is threatening to turn the girls into slaves. One of the few Westerners to have met with the murderous Boko Haram insurgents, Eliza Griswold, who wrote about her encounter in her book, The Tenth Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Islam and Christianity, joins us to discuss the corrupt Nigerian government's inability to protect its own citizens, most of whom live in dire poverty, while government officials steal billions from the country's oil wealth. And we'll also discuss her article at Slate, Why Fear Boko Haram? Then finally, we will speak with a 24-year veteran Foreign Service officer at the State Department, Peter Van Buren, about the urgent need for a diplomatic effort to prevent a war in Ukraine. He spent a year in Iraq leading two State Department provincial reconstruction teams, which he wrote about in a book, We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People, which resulted in him being fired and stripped of his security clearance and diplomatic credentials. We will discuss the White House's efforts to punish Putin by preventing American business leaders from attending a gathering Putin has organized, a move that puts the business leaders in a no-win situation of either offending the White House or Putin, who might punish them by killing their deals in Russia. And joining us now is Dr. Brenda Eckwessel, who is a climate scientist from the Union of Concerned Scientists. She is leading the Union of Concerned Scientists' climate science education work aimed at strengthening support for strong federal climate legislation and sound U.S. climate policies. Her specialty is isotope geochemistry, a tool she has used to study climate variability in places as disparate as the Arctic Ocean and the desert southwest. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Brenda Eckwessel.
Thank you so much. It's good to be with you.
And Brenda, you're actually at the White House. You've been in a meeting, and we're just catching you on the way out after they've handed back your cell phone. Tell me what went on in the meeting, because obviously we're talking to you today because the White House has released a new study from the U.S. Global Change Research Program saying that climate change is no longer a distant threat, but a real and present danger.
Absolutely. It was quite fanfare for the release today. Essentially, Congress requested an assessment of the climate change impacts in the United States, and today the president delivered this report. And it confirms what Americans are already seeing with their own eyes, that the seas are rising, that the punishing heat waves are upon us, the heaviest rain events are getting heavier, and drought more severe. And so this is something that is clear and palpable, the amount of attention that the White House is paying to this report that has what we consider actionable science.
But this is a report that's supposed to be issued at least every 4 years under the Global Change Research Act of 1990. But during the Bush administration, they tried to tamper with the report. So clearly, this issue is still somewhat mired in politics.
What's different about this report is that the transparency and the process and the openness of the process and understanding the science behind these assessment key findings, you can dig deeper in the report if you want to see all the decisions that were made. And the transparency is unparalleled of any national climate assessment that I've seen before. The leadership to make this a much more comprehensive report on that standpoint because of the history is of note, and more importantly, it is very clear to understand what's in the report because people on the ground are trying to protect their local communities, and there's information that really drills down to regional levels and gives examples of folks who are trying to protect their communities for the consequences of climate change.
So do you expect then the usual suspects to come out of the denial lobby, or is this sufficient, do you think, since it's literally giving tools to those on the ground in state and local government to start dealing with this issue? I mean, I take it we're not talking about, you know, stopping climate change anymore. We're talking about adapting to it and trying to mediate it.
Well, there was also a lot of emphasis on the steps to slow the pace of climate change by reducing the emissions from America and the steps that are being taken to increase fuel economy standards, looking at the EPA to use the Clean Air Act and reduce emissions from the power plant sector in the United States, as well as looking at international opportunities as well. So it's a multi-pronged effort to try to use all the tools that the administration has at its disposal to act without needing any additional effort from Congress. Of course, to really, as you say, really make a difference, we do need to have Congress to jump into the fray, understand that the science is clear, climate change is real, it's here now, and it's primarily from burning fossil fuels, which makes it very clear the types of actions that need to be taken.
So given that the report indicates that if emissions continue to rise, temperatures on the very hottest days during the last 20 years of this century may be 10 degrees to 15 degrees hotter across most of the country. We already have a severe drought here in the state of California. The areas most affected are represented by Republican Congress people. So I'm just curious to know whether, you know, the reality on the ground is going to change this peculiar atavistic dogma that's out there in terms of denial.
Well, it's very interesting. At the release today, we had an official from Southeast Florida who talked about Republicans in the state of Florida and Republican mayors in some of the counties and cities, as well as Democratic mayor down there. And yet, when it comes to, as she said, when people are dealing with their streets being flooded during a high tide because the sewage system and the drainage infrastructure is really just a gateway for high tide to come flooding into the streets during a sunny day in Florida, no raindrop around, they know they have a problem and they're calling City Hall and say, do something. And it is totally nonpartisan at the local level. You have to help residents that are dealing with climate change on the ground. And that helped people in that region to realize that they had to get beyond the partisan politics and really start working together and to compete for initiatives to try to get grants to help solve the problems that they're facing there. And California, this is a record drought, and there may be a possibility if the natural cycles go back into an El Nino that there might be some relief with the rain. If it doesn't develop into a strong El Nino, we need to have every tool at our disposal to help with the farmers and ranchers who are dealing with this drought. The food that comes on America's tables are going to be more costly. Drinking water in Southern California to power our electricity system across the nation, we need access to lots of water resources. And one of the findings of the report is that it said that one of the obstacles is that the laws of the nation to deal with water resources, which in drought-prone areas is of acute concern, they have a stationarity principle that we want to restore to what it was before. But the past is no longer necessarily what we're going to face today or even in the future.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Brenda Eckwessel, who is a climate scientist from the Union of Concerned Scientists. She is leading the Union of Concerned Scientists' climate science education work aimed at strengthening support for strong federal climate legislation and sound U.S. climate policies. Her specialty is isotope geochemistry, a tool she's used to study climate variability in places as disparate as the Arctic Ocean and the desert southwest. And she is just leaving the White House now, having been at a meeting at the White House today, where the new report from the U.S. Global Change Research Program was released. And this was a report that was generated by a 60-person advisory committee comprised of government, private, and academic representatives who oversaw the assessments, which took 4 years and involved more than 300 scientists, engineers, and technical experts. So in terms of what we were just talking about, here in California, of course, with the water crisis and this drought that you were suggesting, there may be some good news. On the other hand, it may go on for years, and water will have to be dealt with and rationed. And, you know, we've always had this competition in California between water for people's lawns in the cities and for agribusiness in the big central area of the coast, where so much of the country's fruits and vegetables are grown. Now we also find that our limited water supplies are being in competition with enormous amounts of water that it need for fracking, particularly in the Monterey Shale area. So there's a lot of competition growing for less and less water.
Water is very, very key resource that many people need. And in California, at the end of the pipeline, so to speak, with Colorado River flowing out of the diminishing water resources to the region, because at the time the Colorado River Compact was signed, it had very, very record high flows for the most recent, say, 150-year history, and they happened to sign the compact using the flow at that time, and it hasn't really been that high since. And so the states have to reallocate that water and make decisions about who gets the water. And therefore, many resource planners are looking for other ways to better conserve the water and to make better decisions so that everyone can meet the needs. And water is not something that you want to use in a wasteful way, and fracking certainly does need a lot of water.
So in terms of the Northeast, they've had a 71% increase in storms, you know, including the superstorm Sandy, which did enormous damage. So what was the sense then of, you mentioned Florida, seawater coming into the sewage system. We've talked about California, the battle for water, and the possibility of a long and crippling drought. What was the sense of, again, how the Northeast is going to face this ongoing situation? Because as I was saying earlier, Brenda, it seems to me that we've passed the point of, well, obviously there's much to be done to try and stop global warming, but at this point, aren't we also talking about mitigating its effects?
We do have to prepare and protect ourselves from the consequences of climate change that we already can't avoid, because we've already, from our historic emissions, locked in a certain amount of climate change that we're struggling with and dealing with now. And in order to really avoid some of the worst consequences and to slow the pace of future climate change, to give communities more time to plan and prepare, we do need to dramatically reduce emissions, because we've only just had a taste of the changes that are in store for us if we were to continue unabated.
And is there a sense then that, I mean, obviously this is a global problem, not an American problem, although the industrial West has put up most of the stuff that's up there now, but China and India are coming on. And what was the discussions in the White House about the U.S.'s responsibility to do what it can vis-a-vis a more effective way, which would be for the entire world to cooperate? I mean, I see this as such a problem that I think we need a new form of global patriotism, that we all, as a species on this planet, should band together to protect this planet that's endangered.
We did hear encouraging words at the White House today that essentially the recognition that we have to get our own house in order in the United States, reduce our own emissions, meet targets that are set in all energy structures, in the ways we produce energy, how we use energy. And in 2012, we did reduce the emissions of heat-trapping gases in the United States, which was a good feat. And in order to show leadership internationally to encourage the rest of the world's large emitters to step up and do more as well. As long as we don't have our house in order, the White House officials today were indicating that we don't have a chance of really solving this unless we bring all nations on board that really are making the most contribution to the historical emissions as well as future emissions. And so we know that emerging economies are contributing more and more to emissions. And the people who are extracting more fossil fuels in order to fire up our economies there is going to be a big change on the energy front and where we go in the future, because we know the cost of further extraction has to eventually be phased out.
So we've discussed, Brenda Ekwessel, the drought and how the snowpack is melting here in California. And, of course, this extends the wildfire season. And we already had some hot days here in Southern California just a week ago that were, you know, the worst of the fire hazards that you normally get much, much later in the year. So there's no question that things are changing. But in a very basic sense, you know, in terms of the science, my understanding is that as the big ice packs on the poles melt, and we've seen that these glaciers and these huge icebergs breaking off, that means literally that the sunlight that's reflected off the white surfaces of the pole that goes back into outer space is not happening, because more and more, as the polar ice caps shrink, therefore you have more and more dark water that absorbs the light rather than reflects it back into outer space. Is that the fundamental cycle that we're talking about here?
Absolutely. The polar regions, you have amplification of the change. For example, in the parts of the lower United States, we have changes on several degrees rise since the pre-industrial period, but Alaska has many, many more degrees rise that are projected by the end of the century, because it's up in the polar region where you have those processes you were just talking about with shrinking ice and the amplification, the polar amplification of the climate change signal, which really affects all of us, because as soon as you raise the sea level, and if you put seafood, and you buy seafood to eat during the day, then you have a connection to the coast and the sea level rise that those coastal communities are affecting, are feeling.
So I had heard at one point somebody made a suggestion, and it sounded a little off the wall, but I just wanted to run it by you, that maybe that we should paint every roof on the face of the planet white and start figuring ways to reflect light back into outer space. Does that make any sense?
Yes, there are calculations to do that. There are also other people who want to have green roofs so that you can ameliorate, try to grow as much, you know, woody vegetation and try to have as much photosynthesis going on and turn it into energy, help with runoff, or try to not have impermeable surfaces, and to help cool the roofs. So there are many different strategies out there, and all of them depend on where you live and the types of engineering structures that you have.
And is some of these ideas in this new report that we're talking
about? Yes, it has practical guidance and very very interesting case studies, and the areas it identifies opportunities in each sector, and it also identifies challenges that are out there that we do need to be careful and smart about overcoming.
So this means that the individual, in terms of what's called your global warming individual footprint or your carbon footprint, you know, so far we've sort of, you know, recycled our plastics and papers in one bin and, you know, garbage in another and the green in another, and it doesn't seem like very much. So this means that there's some serious things that individuals can do above and beyond what we've been doing so far. And of course, you know, that means buying Priuses and, you know, electric cars when you can afford them, and they seem to be getting cheaper. But then there are problems with batteries as well, ecologically speaking. So is there going to be a leap forward in what the individual can do?
There's only so much we can do as individuals, but we can do a lot by sending signals to businesses that we do want more efficient appliances, more efficient cars, and we want more efficient homes and buildings where we work. And that will go a long way. Energy efficiency is the low-hanging fruit. Beyond that, we do need governments. We do need Congress to step up. We do need international leaders, and we do need bilateral negotiations between countries and multilateral negotiations between the large emitters to really take a big bite out of our emissions to the atmosphere and look for the energy champions of the future.
Well, Dr. Brenda Ekwessel, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for calling attention to this important report.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Brenda Ekwessel, who is a climate scientist from the Union of Concerned Scientists. She's leading the Union of Concerned Scientists' climate science education work aimed at strengthening support for strong federal climate legislation and sound U.S. climate policies. Her specialty is isotope geochemistry, a tool she's used to study climate variability in places as disparate as the Arctic Ocean and the desert southwest. And we just spoke with her from the White House, where she'd been attending a meeting with the release of the U.S. Global Change Research Program's report. We're going to take a brief station break. We look into what U.S. help might be being offered to the Nigerian government to free the over 200 schoolgirls captured by Boko Haram.